Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
It's a simple greeting you'll hear every day in the Midlands.
I love the greeting, A-up.
But for my latest Midlander, those two words say a lot about the people who say them.
It says you can't be the big I am if you're saying A-up. It says, I know you, you know me, we'll be here tomorrow. Let's not make a fuss about it.
Henry Norble has worked with top comedians, talented writers, leading actors. But he thinks there's something different about Midlanders who make it.
When I think about all the famous people from Nottingham and from the East Midlands, you don't get anybody coming the big I am. I don't think we can. I don't think it's in our DNA.
This is Made in the Midlands. This episode was commissioned by the Newark Book Festival and it was recorded in front of a live audience in the town's Palace Theatre. It's hosted by Adrian Goldberg.
Is there such a thing as a Midlander? There are people who live in what we call the English Midlands, but do those 10 million or so people have any kind of shared identity? I'm on a mission to find out.
Episode 10, Henry Normal. Born in Nottingham, Henry could have been a greengrocer. He was a successful insurance broker, but he became a poet and a writer, helping create some of the best-loved comedies in Britain. With Carolina Hearn and Craig Cash, he co-wrote The Royal Family. His baby cow production company that he founded with Steve Coogan developed Gavin and Stacey. He's still a season ticket holder at Nottingham Forest, and he started the Nottingham Poetry Festival. His story takes in a famous record shop, Seamus Heaney, and a cheque for £1 million.
Please welcome the man christened Peter James Carroll, better known as Henry Normal.
Hey, up.
Sometimes you have called yourself a northerner, but do you identify with the Midlands? Do you think of yourself as a Midlander?
I think when I was younger, there was an anti-London sort of feeling. And there was an us and them about London. I never quite understood what it was that was wrong with them. They'd say soft southerners, and I'd think, well, what's wrong with being soft? You know, I quite like being soft. So I didn't quite understand it. So I suppose in that way, I thought of myself as being not London, and therefore I sort of shortcut that to the north. But of course, I've gigged all around the country. So if you gig up in Newcastle, they think people from Durham are soft southerners. Now I embrace the fact that it's the Midlands, and I love coming from Nottingham. And there's lots of brilliant things about the East Midlands. And there is a certain look to Nottinghamshire, and I love that about it, yeah.
In terms of the Midlands being a key part of your identity, you made a film, didn't you, about Nottingham Forest European Cup win as well, I believe,
did, yeah.
In miracles.
Yeah, I was a producer, yeah.
Yeah, and just that sense of growing up with success in football and football being a key to your local identity here?
Well, I think football is like a soap opera, isn't it? We crave stories, don't we? We're always craving stories. And I used to go with Nigel Kirkwood, who's a mate of mine who's here to... I'll be stopping at his house later, so I have to be nice to him. I have to give him a name check. That's my price of my bed and breakfast. When we were little, when we were about 14, we'd go and we'd be the first ones in the ground, Trent End. It would be half one, we'd go for a 3 o'clock kickoff. And I had a red cagoule and I'd got some Snowpake, Tipex, and I'd put all the names of the players all down my arms, you know, in Storymore. That was a long one. You know, and then, of course, when he left for Man United, I tried to un-Tipex it out. And I used to love going, and you'd walk down Arkwright Street with everybody else, and there's just like this sort of flood of people. It was a great sense of community. And even, I'm going back now, and some of you are about as old as me, so you'll remember, they had the first wave of skinheads, and the skinheads used to go to, for it. They didn't go to county. I don't know, the Grebos went to county. And they used to do their Grebo dance at county, which was weird because my brother were a county fan. But Forest had the skinheads. And even though I had a centre part in, imagine me at 14, I got a centre part in and ringlets. I was a looker. And I'd go down there and I'd have like a multicoloured T-shirt I got from my sister. And I'd have loons, which were £2.50, and plimsolls. And because I had a Forest scarf on, there wouldn't be any messing. But I remember once not having a Forest scarf on, and a skinhead came up to me. He got the braces and the haircut and everything. And he went, "You're not worth kicking." And I thought, that's exactly the look I'm going for. I tell you what, with some of the first poems as such I'd hear on the terraces. So back in the 1970s, I remember as a 14-year-old, I went, and there was this chant, it went, "With a knock-kneed chicken and a bow-legged hen, we haven't had a fight since we don't know when. We don't care where and we don't care when. We are the Trent End Boo Boys." And then they do a little dance. La 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 la. We are the Trent End Boo Boys. Oh, God bless you. Thank you. And I remember looking up at them and thinking, "You're older than me, Dad."
Tell me where you grew up, Henry. Was it a place called St Anne's?
St Anne's, yeah. There's a lovely documentary that is up on YouTube, which was made by Stephen Frears. Now, Stephen Frears directed the film Philomena, so I got to meet him, and he used to live in St Anne's in the 1960s when I was there. I was born actually at home in St Anne's in 1956, and I lived there till I was nine, and then we moved to the knocked our place down and we moved to Bilborough. And the film Stephen Frears has made is 1969, and you're months away from the 70s, and it's like Bosnia at the height of the war. I looked at it and I watched it through and I wept. I absolutely wept. I didn't know we were so poor. I'd got no idea that my mum and dad had had to live through that. Because as a kid, you sort of live in your own world. We used to go and play in the bombed out buildings. I must have been about six, and I found a gas mask in amongst the rubble. And I did the worst thing possible. I put it on and breathed in. And all this air that had been there since 1944, like, oh, I went into my lungs and I got some sort of pneumonia or something and nearly died. So I was nearly the last casualty of the Second World War. That's Hitler's plan to get me. And to me, that I was having fun and I was loved and I had great mates and it never occurred to me that we were poor. My very first memory is having a plastic fire engine when I was out for my third birthday, you know, with yellow ladders and just, you know, rolling it back and forwards. So to me, it was never about what I hadn't got, it was what I had got. And you know, people say, oh, we didn't lock the doors. We didn't lock the doors. It's not a myth. It's a fact. We never locked the doors. Because if somebody came to burgle you, every curtain would twitch. Everybody knew who was in whose house. So we've lost something.
Yeah, so that what I mean, that was, I guess, an area that was a victim of slum clearance.
It was. And the funny thing was, we owned our slum. I don't know if my dad was quite as astute as I'd like him to have been, but he bought it, I don't know, for about 3 shilling, I should imagine, back in them days. And so we had a different coloured door to everybody else, because my mum insisted on it being pink. So it was like green for the corporation all up and down the road, and then this one house in the middle with a pink door, because my mum was, she thought she was Greta Garbo or something. But then they knocked them all down, and they were bad, and they were damp, and I mean, there were no central heating, of course. If you were cold, you stood in front of the gas cooker. You'd turn the gas cooker on, make sure your mum and dad didn't know, and stand there, and I got scorch marks on every shirt at the back. I have got great fond memories of those days, and I always remember you had corner shops. And then when they moved us to Bilborough, so they made this council estate, they didn't move anybody from our street to Bilborough. Mm. Right? Now, you'd think, as a sense of community, they'd have moved you so that you could keep in touch. Nobody from that street moved to Bilborough. So we were moved, I don't know if they, like, sectioned us off.
But
they can get it. So we went to Bilborough, and we didn't have a corner shop. What you had was a parade of shops that was for everybody. And at the corner shop, they would know your name. And so they'd go in and they'd go, oh, hello, Henry. You want some fags for your dad? I won't give him any money. They'd put it on the slate. And get some chocolate. Don't bother about that. Don't bother mentioning that. And then when we went to Bilborough, you got this parade and you went to Co-op and they didn't know your name. You had a number. So I had a co-op number. So I'd become, from having a name, I'd become a number. And I think that's symptomatic of what happened and what's still happening in this way, that sense of community has been eroded year after year after year until now we're all on the internet, aren't we?
Tell me about your mum and dad.
My dad worked at Raleigh, and my mum had 5 kids, so she was busy. I suppose my dad must have been busy at some point.
Was there a sense of pride in the fact that he worked for Raleigh, which now we view as a kind of iconic factory, or was it just another place?
I think there was. I think, you know, there were Raleigh, Plessy, Boots, players, and you thought that we're a city that makes things. I seem to remember thinking that was a source of pride. My mum died when I was 11. But before that, she started up a business of selling fruit and veg door to door, a bit like Just Eat. Except in the 70s. And she was doing really, really well. Had she not have died, I'd have probably been a greengrocer. I'm probably a lot happier. I would think it'd be nice to think that I'd be the head of Tesco's by now. My dad, of course, he joined the war. He was in the RAF as a young man, and then he worked at the gun factory in Nottingham, and then he worked at Raleigh, and then he retired. Always wore a suit, my dad, throughout his entire life. Even as a child, I think he wore a suit. He was very much an old-fashioned sort of bloke. And I know he loved us to bits, but he would never say, I love you. Never once in his life. He died when he was 90. His last words were, put your hat on. It looks a bit cold out there. That was his way of saying, I love you. Put your hat on. I felt very much working class all my life, I think. And even now, even though I made a few bob. My dad instilled upon me, and my mum, a sense of duty and a sense of working hard. I say he worked Saturday and Sunday morning, even though he got 5 kids, and he never would take one penny from government or local government.
Well, I've got to say that theme of working hard is one of the persistent themes of our made in the Midlands guess. Your mum sounds like an absolute force of nature, though. Five kids, sets up her own green grocery business. Did her loss drive you into the world of books?
Well, I was very gregarious before then. I'd got no thoughts of books. You know, I'd sort of wanted to be a footballing astronaut. Or, you know, something like that. And then when my mum died, I became quite withdrawn. So I started reading books and getting into myself and trying to find escapes. And that's a lovely thing about books and films, that you can escape into another world. And being on a council estate in the 70s, it was better to escape. I mentioned my mate Nige. We used to do a disco for old age pensioners. Back when I was about 16, I had a turntable. It was like a dance set type thing. And we'd take it to the Old Age Pensioners Club where Nigel's mum and dad used to run it. And we'd play records from them. And sometimes, if you played March of the Mods, because they weren't very fit, we'd play the 45 at 33. And that was where I saw the first ever live comedian. And it was a young bloke, and Nigel and I are always joking, and we were joking with him, and he didn't say a word. Very quiet. And I thought, well, he's not going to be very funny. And he dressed up as a young kid. He was a grown man, but he dressed up as a young kid, and he went on. And I always remember his first joke. He went, my mum says, what do you want for Christmas? I says, I want something to wear and something to play with. So she brought me these pants with holes in the pockets. and the old people absolutely loved him. And then he came off and he was as miserable as sin. And I thought, that's obviously what you need to do. I said, no good me being cheerful off stage.
Throughout our podcast, we ask people for their Midlands memories. I'm going to take you to school years now, because that's where your Midlands memory comes from, isn't it?
Midlands memory.
This is
about my school teacher.
Yeah.
So, and I'm seeing him tomorrow. Seeing my English teacher tomorrow, and I ain't seen him since school, and he's in his 90s.
Peter Inskey?
Peter Inskey. And he was a great teacher. There were teachers at school who'd let you get away with it. And you'd go into class and you'd say, what did you do during the war? And they'd spend the whole of the half hour telling you about the war, and you'd learn nothing. One history, you know, it'd be biology or something. But Peter Inskey did English, and you had to do your English homework, and he was strict, and I loved him for that. And he got me very involved in trying to do my best. That was a lovely thing. You couldn't get away with not doing your best, and I loved that about him. And there's one incident that happened. This strange enough, it's about school, but it's not about school work as such. So in class one day, my mum had not long since died. He said, "Where's your own work?" And he was at the front of the class, and I was towards the back. And I said, I haven't done it because I was doing housework. He said, "That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that you excuse. You come up with a better excuse than that." And I felt really bad about it. And the next day, I was in maths, and he came into the maths class, and he asked the maths teacher if he could have a word with me. He took me out into the corridor, and he apologised to me. He didn't know that my mum had died, and somebody obviously told him. And here he was, a grown man, and here I was, probably 11. And it was quite weird because I felt at school that I wasn't really seen. I wasn't really noticed. And there was a grown man apologising to a young boy. And for all the things they teach you at school, that sticks with me as integrity. And I wanted to do my best for him. I've got to say I'm a bit emotional now. Because so I'm seeing him tomorrow, and I'm going to tell him this story. And he probably doesn't know this story. He's probably forgot. But what you learn at school and what stays with you is not necessarily what other people think. And I went away thinking, I want to be as good as that man.
That's a great memory, isn't it? Absolutely beautiful.
I must tell you a little story about Peter Inskeep, just because it's just come into my head. Because he got a great sense of humour as well when I was about 13. It was sex education. We had the one lesson. And you had to write your question on a piece of paper, and then he read out the question. And somebody had written, and he wrote, read it out, what is OMO? Spelled O-M-O. And he said, it's a washing powder.
You've talked a little bit about your dad and, you know, how he was probably relatively distant by today's standards and your mum was pretty gregarious and outgoing by the sounds of it. How much of your own family experience fed into the royal family?
Oh, lots. I was very lucky. When I arrived in Manchester, I met Caroline Ahern and Steve Coogan and lots of other people. Frank Skinner used to come up a lot from Birmingham, Linda Smith over from Sheffield. And you've got to remember, we were very young, so nobody had been on television. We were all trying to pay the rent. You'd get maybe £30 for a gig, £70 if you were lucky. And we'd travel together in cars. So, you know, if you was going up to, say, Aberdeen, it'd be like four of you in a car going to Aberdeen. You didn't know anybody in Aberdeen. So there was very much a sense of community and a sense of, you know, troops in the trenches about it. So I love that sense of community. And I was offered a TV series called Packet of Three. Now, they didn't actually say it like that. They said, would you like to be on television? And I said, yeah, go on then. They said, what do you want to do? And so I said, let's rip off the Muppets. I said, nobody will notice. I'll be Kermit. Frank can be Gonzo. And I wanted Linda Smith to be Miss Piggy. And they said, oh, no, Jenny Clear is more vivacious in that way. And so, you know, say it was, my idea. I said, we've got to film it in the north. So we filmed it in Wakefield. And I got all my mates on. So I got Steve doing his first ever national television character.
Steve Coogan.
I got Dave Gorman on. I got Lem Sisse. So I got all my mates on. And basically everybody that didn't live in London who were funny was on that programme. I wasn't very good in it, I didn't think. I would try my best. But I think you had to be cool in them days. And I was a bit too chummy. I wasn't very cool. And I didn't feel very comfortable. So I was asked by Caroline to help her write the Mrs. Merton show. And at the same time, I was asked by Steve to help him write Coogan's Run and Paul and Pauline Calf. So I was working for both Steve and Caroline at the same time. So I was working nights, a bit like my dad. I was working nights, I was working Sundays, I was working Saturdays, I was working in the morning, I was working at night. Paul Calf is very working class and very northern. And there's a lot of my upbringing, probably my brother Dave, my older brother, in Paul Calf, and lots of things that he would say, I'd put into that. But when we sat down to write The Royal Family, there was me, Caroline and Craig. Now, Caroline and Craig have both been brought up on council estates as well. And we sat down, and Caroline said, what does your dad say? I remember it as clear as day. And we sat sixth floor of the Granada building. What does your dad say? And we just wrote down things that our parents said. In the first episode, you'll notice the dad, Ricky Tomlinson, says, who's been phoning Aberdeen? Because all our dads were careful with money. Like, you know, like my dad would say that the immersion heater was poisonous. And he'd say, are you in this room or are you in that room? And I'd say, I'm in this room. And he'd say, well, what's the light doing on in that room? So we wrote all these things down, and people said, that's like my dad. But it was weird because it took 2 years to get it to film, because the bosses didn't understand. Even the first week he was on, The Guardian said it was written by three posh people. Now, in my wildest dreams, I'd like to pretend I'm posh, right? But nobody could accuse Caroline and Craig of ever being able to pretend that they were posh. It just not happening. So it's funny how, and now looking back, The Guardian, you go, oh no, we knew, we was like, ironic. We're being ironic. Dig it up your ass. And we wrote it from our childhood. This is us remembering our childhood. Right, but the thing is, it don't change that much. So people think, well, that's actually bang up to date. But it was actually us remembering our childhood. Not only words, but characteristics of my mum and my dad in there. And us as kids, you know, my sisters are in there and things I've said.
So you'd become a successful Midlands writer, which brings us to your Midlands hero. Oh, yeah. Who's that?
Alan Sillitoe is one of the people who made me believe that you could write as a working class lad. Because you've got to go back. So when I'm about 17 and I'm writing in my bedroom, it's not a proper job, as my dad would say, right? The idea that you could make a living as a writer, it didn't seem possible. And to write the sort of things that I knew. Now, if you think about it, Stephen Fry is a brilliant writer, but he couldn't write The Royal Family. Because he didn't live that. So it was that idea of being able to write from your own experience. And Alan Sillitoe captured that for me. So Saturday night, Sunday morning, obviously my dad worked at Raleigh, and he told me that when he left, when he were retired, 65, they had the same machines in there that they had in the film. That's why they went downhill. My brother worked at Raleigh, and if I had to... got a soft job. I'd have worked at Raleigh. So it was definitely the world that I inhabited that he was doing. And The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, there's the moment in that, and we've taught it at school, but I read it as well, just for me. And I remember reading it, and there's the bit where he stops running. And it puzzled me for a while. When somebody does something that you wouldn't do, you sort of go, why are you doing that? And then when I understood that he'd rather lose on his own terms than win on somebody else's, that was something epic to hold on to. Mm-hmm. And that to be yourself and to make your own decisions and define yourself. And I love that.
And you did that personally, didn't you? In that you had a career in insurance, you went off to Hull, we'll gloss over that, but then you came back to the Midlands to live with your sister and be on the dole to pursue that dream, to lose, if necessary, on
yes,
your own terms.
Yes, I'd love to say that was entirely down to Alan Sillitoe, but I was sat in Hull in a place called Cecil the Cinema. On my own, and I didn't know anybody else. And punk had just happened, and I'd got a house, and I was a head of an insurance brokers, right, and I was about 22. And there I was, I got my knives in the knife bit, my forks in the fork bit, my spoons in the spoon bit, and I was about 70. And yet I was in my 20s. And I was thinking, what have I done? I've lived my life already. And too much too young was released, and I was listening to Too Much Too Young, and then I was sat in Cecil Cinema and Animal House came on, and I looked at these people having fun and I thought, they're older than me. What am I doing? Why have I got this proper job? I'm going to go and have an adventure. So it was wanting an adventure and then going, well, what is it that I can say to the world? What have I got to add to the huge soap opera of life? And I wanted to add some truth. And so it's about the truth of my life up until that point. I did actually meet Alan Sillitoe. So when I set up the Manchester Poetry Festival about 27 years ago, I'd done Packet of Three and I wasn't very happy with myself. And I thought, I've got this money, I've got about £6,000 that they give me. And I thought, I'm going to use this money to make somebody happy. And I used about £3,000 of this money, set up this thing, and I invited Alan Sillitoe to come, and I put myself on with him. so I could meet him. And here he was, his poetry festival, and he came up to Manchester and he said, "I'm not reading any poems." And he read short stories, and I love him for that. Cantankerous old bugger. He was doing what he wanted to do, you know, no matter whether it was a poetry festival. So it was lovely to meet him.
Well, brilliant stuff. And when you came back to Nottingham, and you've got a little fanzine poetry book here. What were the places, what were the scenes, who were the people that then gave you the confidence to perform and to be the success that you are?
Well, I came back, and this is a nice little book. So this is, look at that. Staggering 19 poems. This was my first book, and it was paid for by East Midlands Arts. The cover design was by a friend of mine, Pete Ramskill, who's in the audience and is still a huge friend to this day, and I've not paid him. there was a great sense of community in Nottingham. There was a cabaret circuit going on, and lots of creatives. Midlands Arts up in Ockley used to be a place I'd go to, and I always remember being on with a bloke who spent 20 minutes beating up a bag of onions. 20 minutes beating up a bag of onions, he got 70 quid. And he was dressed as a boxer, and he beat it up, and he'd cry as he was doing it. And I thought, that's not bad. 20 minutes, 70 quid, I can do that. I'd do gigs and get a bit. And then I'd travel round to Birmingham, to Leicester, to Loughborough, and sort of build up my confidence. And, you know, obviously, once they've heard your jokes in Nottingham, you've got to tell them somewhere else.
This, for people who can't see it on the podcast, it's a little A3 booklet, Is Love Science Fiction by Henry Normal, published by East Midlands Art. So, and in terms of the earliest gigs you did, the Midlands very much nurtured you. And there was one music shop in particular that you say had a real bearing on how you ran your very successful baby care production company.
Well, Selectedisc was more than a shop. They had a settee in there, which freaked me out. The idea that you would have a settee in a shop. Do you know what I mean? You went in a shop, you bought something, you came out. You didn't have a little sit on the... I mean, it was a dusty old springy settee. And it smelt of drugs. And it was dark, and all the walls were painted black. So if you wanted to buy, like, a Led Zeppelin album or something, you'd either go in Boots and you'd change the label so it was 72p. I apologise to anybody who bought Acabilt for £2.50. And that was all bright, and you know, and there was people buying deodorants and stuff like that. Or you went in Selectedisc, where nobody bought deodorant. And they had the settee, and they had bands wanted, and drummer wanted. And it was like you're entering this world. And I'll tell you what the word was: enthusiasts. It was for music enthusiasts. And that's what I was at the time. I was an enthusiast, and I wanted to dwell and to enjoy it. So when I set up Baby Cow with Steve Coogan, and we were the first working class comedians ever to set up a production company, right? If you look at all the production companies before that, they're all Oxford and Cambridge. And we were the first people who'd not been to Oxford and Cambridge to set up that. I wanted it to be like Selectedisc. So I got all my mates, I got everybody that I could, and I said, it's like a community arts thing, and I want us all to interact. So the very first show that we made was called Nighty Night with Julia Davis and Rob Brydon. And in that show, we had Ruth Jones, who went on to work with us on Gavin and Stacey. And there was that thing of bringing people on, nursery slopes. And I did this with the festival, so both the Nottingham Festival and the Manchester Festival. I'd put on headliners, so I had Seamus Heaney the day after he'd won the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
Right? And I'd put him on with Lem Sisse, who was a young lad at the time and is now an international star. I did that with the way that we ran Baby Cow, that we'd bring people on and they would do a bit part and then they would get their own series. I should have to tell you about Seamus Heaney. So I didn't realise he was coming straight from Sweden. So he'd won the Nobel Prize, like you do. And he came on the plane and we met him at the airport and he got a cheque in his pocket for £1 million. Right? I said, we've got you on at the art gallery. It's about 400, 500 people there. I said, we've got you some money. He said, have you got cash? He says, all I've got is this cheque for £1 million. He says, I can't even buy a Mars bar.
It's just great to hear how, even when you were successful in Manchester, how the Midlands and a record shop in Nottingham could influence that culture and permeate through. Which brings us to your Midlands masterpiece, then, which is...
Well, I think it's Slab Square, the Lions and the Council House. And I love that we call it the Council House. It's with the old joke of, if that's a council house, I want one of them.
This is in Nottingham.
In Nottingham. And what it does is it centres you. It gives you a lovely sense of this as the centre. And when I put the Nottingham Poetry Festival, I made sure that we had banners on the council house. So it wasn't like this is a festival tucked behind somewhere. Here it was, right on the council. So when I first started work, Ernest A. Notcutt, who was the place I worked, it was on the South Parade. And so I overlooked the Slab Square, as I call it. And, of course, it's changed over the years. When the festival came, they'd have, bands there. And if you look back on the old pictures, you used to have Goose Fair on there at one point. It's got that lovely sense of self. And I love that it's got a centre. And it's a brilliant building. I remember at Christmas as a kid going through the centre of the building and seeing all the Christmas lights up. And that was a treat. The sculptures and everything. It is a gorgeous building. And the square says that we're open. We're open for business. I like that.
Yeah, well, I like the fact that we haven't lost you. We haven't lost you either to Manchester or to down south where you live now, because you are still very active with the Poetry Festival.
I would live in Nottingham if it had a coast. Now, the way global warming's going, I might not be so long. But my wife has to live by the coast. She's part mermaid.
Well, as I say, you are very active here. You've got the Poetry Festival. Yeah. You're still going to support Forest as well.
And I tried just before COVID. I'd set up doing all 64, I think it is, of the Nottinghamshire libraries. And I was going to do it for free, because the libraries helped me start. And this book, that was published because I went to a group at the Central Library. And...
That's your first book.
That's my first book. And I wanted to give back. So we'd set up this tour, and I was going to have a different poet with me, a local poet at each one, and we were going to go around. And then COVID came, and we weren't able to do it. So we did some stuff online. And I'm hoping to reset it up so that nobody's ever done it, and it'd be nice to do everyone. Last year, I did every one of the Nottingham libraries. So there's 12 Nottingham libraries, and a couple of them they were trying to shut down, which they're not. Now, so I'm very happy with that.
I just want to get your Midlands manifesto from us. Then a lot of people who've spoken about this on the podcast have talked about the Midlands being done down a little bit, maybe a little bit of chippiness on our shoulder, feeling we could do better. What's your Midlands manifesto?
I don't know if it's a Midlands, but it's certainly a Nottingham manifesto, and I think it spreads out. But I love the greeting, A up. It says you can't be the big I am if you're saying A up. Do you know what I mean? You can't imagine Prince or King Charles, as he is now, going A up. Do you know what I mean? It sort of says that we're on the same level. And it sort of says, to me, it says, I know you, you know me, we'll be here tomorrow. Let's not make a fuss about it. And I remember as a kid, that was sort of my dad's attitude. It was, if there was a panic or so, he'd go, oh, we'll get through it. Don't make a big drama out of it. Let's get it, together. When I think about all the famous people from Nottingham and from the East Midlands, you don't get anybody coming the big I am. I don't think we can. I don't think it's in our DNA to that. There is something very... grounded about it. And I say, to me, the phrase A up encapsulates that grounded.
Well, I hear something that's also very West Midlands and therefore is very Midlands. And again, that is a theme that has emerged. You're going to do a little poem for us, I think.
Called The Lost Arrow. You'll remember when you used to go to Nottingham Castle as a kid, somebody would always nick the arrow. And I always used to think to the council, you've got an outlaw there. Oh, you reckon's our hero? And you're wondering, we're not going to nick the arrow. And I always wonder where that arrow went to. And because I've moved around the country a bit, I sort of identified with the arrow, the lost arrow. My welcome is unassuming, instilled from first smack. There is no need for ceremony amongst kin, as if to say, I will see your face again. This is where we are. This is who we are. This is who we'll be when we next meet. There is a matter of factness to this heritage, born from the legacy of human industry, the early morning bus to Raleigh Island, the truth of hard work done well, openness unbowed and easy civility, warmth in the most cutting of winds. Slab Square is where I celebrate, centred yet embracing change. I breathe to the pace of a northern boulevard, my veins run forest red. I carry Nottingham in my bones. It will outlast this temporary flesh. I have an handcrafted sense of self, individual, yet part of something solid. From red brick terrace to green estate, from Brenlard Island to the park, I've lived this old city in all its seasons, loved and ached and mourned at every curb. My accent is in the architecture, in the unsung history of its pavements, in the immediacy of a Saturday night, in the friendliness to strangers. My souls have worn on these streets, my dreams taken flight under this sky. In the eyes of the grand, I may have little, but what I have is mine. Assured, with a quiet defiance, I carry Nottingham in my bones. Nothing under heaven can take it away.
Made in the Midlands is devised by producer Andrew Smith. That music is composed by me, Maya Miller-Lewis. I also researched this episode. Richard Berry is executive producer and sound design is by Dan King. We're all Midlanders, as is our host, Adrian Goldberg.
There are more episodes with Ken Loach, Jess Phillips, Lee Child and Ellie Simmons, amongst others, available on all the main podcast platforms. Please feel free to review and recommend to your friends and family. And if you'd like to get in touch, perhaps to tell us about your own Midlands heroes, memories, masterpieces or manifestos, email us at madeinthemidlands@loftusmedia.co.uk.
Thanks ever so much for coming and seeing us
Listen,
tonight.
Listen, guys, it has been a wonderful night. Henry Normal, thank you.
Made in the Midlands is a Loftus Media production, with special thanks to the supporters of this edition, the Newark Book Festival. Ta-ra!
Hey up.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.